This is the Charlie Duke interview for March 2003.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes, Charlie.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, it was. Yeah, John and I were supposed to be the first to use the rover on our mission, but due to the cancellation of the last two Apollos, they moved it up to Apollo 15 as the first. But since we were going to be the first ones to drive it, or to ride it, we were involved in the initial crew interface with the thing. Went out to Santa Barbara to test drive, and then up to Boeing. Got involved in layout of the instrument panel, the seatbelt configuration, the deployment mechanisms, all of the things like that that we were going to use and have to understand. We also, I remember right, went to Marshall a number of times, sat in on preliminary design reviews and CDRs, they call them, which were critical reviews. And we also rode the simulator up there sometimes in the early days. I don't remember any major. Anything that was of a major hindrance to operation of the rover. The engineers, I thought, had done a good job in the main, position the switches, maybe guards and switches and things like that that were, had to be useful, had to be pulled on. Switch guards and things like that, make sure you can operate things in the pressure suits, get gloves on, and That's correct. I think it was just because of the, let me just say, I think, it was because of the way your hand rested, on a joystick, and sitting down to push forward, on a joystick that would, rock forward to go forward, was difficult to hold, and the T-handle made it such that your hand could just rest on top, and you didn't have to necessarily grip it, and you just pushed instead of twisted, twisted your wrist. Or flexed your wrist, if it was a regular joystick, it would be, to push forward, you have to flex down, and that would have been difficult to hold, so John suggested, if I recall, John suggested we go to a T-handle, which really worked well. I can't remember what was wrong with the automatic deployment. It just seemed to me that a crew involvement in a deployment would be better, a better operation, and you could control it rather than just to completely automatic, where you just pull the handle and the thing just flops out. So. We helped with the engineers in the deployment of this thing. It was folded up, so the vehicle basically had to be folded up. The chassis came in three sections. Yeah, and it was folded up very ingeniously. And then once we released the upper pins, John did that when he crawled out onto the porch, and then I came out later, and we just went around, and we had some lanyards, and we just pulled these lanyards, and through jack screw type arrangement, we cranked it out to the pins pulled, which held the chassis fore and aft, and they just flopped open. Like landing gear deploying on an airplane. Well, I think we had two 1G trainers. One that was used on geology trips. I remember we went out west with it a couple of times, more than that, probably four or five times. And we drove it around the western deserts of Arizona, Nevada, places like that. And it seemed to me it was a more powerful machine. There's a couple of pictures of us. We weren't in spacesuits. We were just in shirt sleeves, and we had a backpack on, and we had a radio, Now I think that was a different. Don't hold me to this, but I think that was a different machine than the one we used in training. And when we had our spacesuits on, that training was all done at Kennedy Space Center, and we had a rover track that was cut out of the swamp behind the training building, every 400 or 500 meters, we would have this simulated moon stop, you know, a place that had boulders scattered around and some craters that they had basically just built. And at each of those places, we would stop the car and we would climb out and we would turn on the TV. We would do the experiments that were assigned at various places that we were on the moon. That these stops didn't look anything like the ones we were going to have on the moon, but we pretended that they were, and we collected rocks like we were supposed to collect them. We did field penetration, you know, surface bearing strength, and we did core tubes, and we did all of that stuff. Well, it actually, getting into the car in 1G was easier than up on the moon. Down here, you had the weight of the backpack, it was lightweight backpack, if I remember, it weighed about 95 pounds. But the weight of the suit and the weight of the backpack enabled you to bend the suit easier down here than you could up on the moon. You know, I just remember getting into the car put your rear end on the seat first and then swing your legs in type deal. And then able to cinch up the seatbelt fairly normally and easily. But up on the moon, the way I found to get in was to reach over and hold on to one of the antenna posts and sort of spring, sort of give a little up and down, you know, like one potato, two potato thing, where you bend in your knees as much as you can, and then jump up in the air and pull hard, and you landed on the seat. You could jump up on the moon, but you couldn't. The suit was so stiff, you couldn't just sit down on the seat and then swing your legs in. It just didn't work that way. And we found that out in the airplane, the zero gravity airplane that we, actually with 1/6 gravity, we were practicing that with this one. Best way we found to get in and out of the rover. Right. We call it the bomb and comet. Well, we didn't. A lot of the photographers and the other people did, but the astronauts, none of us ever got sick. When we felt like we were going to get sick, we just stopped. The poor guys working with us, they got sick before we did. They just had bags.
Well, I'm looking at a photograph here that's taken in Washington, and there are two astronauts there, and I'm glad it's Johnson and Hayes. I mean, Hayes.
A lot of those one-liners, I don't remember what it was either, but yeah. Oh yeah, we did. We had a big debriefing about that. And one of the things that we figured out, though, is the seatbelt was unacceptable that we had designed for the first flight, and so we changed the seatbelt so that it would be easier to attach and easier to cinch up.
Seatbelt is
That was the only change that was made between Apollo 15 and 16 that I recall. We had some anomalies on the moon with the system. I think our steering went out, I think it's our rear steering went out once, but it started working again. And if I recall, that was the only anomaly we had during the whole flight. It was a great view. The lunar module, our trajectory brought us in face up, which meant the windows were pointed up into space. We couldn't see the moon until we got to an altitude of about 7,000 feet. And at that point, the vehicle pitches down, and the windows are now pointed towards the moon, so you can see your landing spot. And we instantly recognized our landing area. There were three major craters in our landing area that were, we had named Lone Star and Gator. And we saw these big craters. They were more than 700 meters in diameter, if I recall. And we realized we were a little, according to our guidance, we were going to be a little west, a little long, and a little north of our, which would have been right, a little right, and a little long of our Kennan landing spot. So we started redesignating our Yandian to bring us down to close to where we were supposed to land. We had some maneuverability with the lunar module. And I remember looking to the north. One of our objectives to the north was a place called North Ray Crater, which was the farthest point to the north that we would be attempting to reach on our third day. And before the flight, we were very concerned about the roughness of the terrain and the number of boulders and blocks, large rocks that would be scattered across the surface. And so I looked up that way and didn't see any big ones particularly, and I made a comment. I said, "John, it looks pretty smooth up that way. We're going to make it." Then we got busy in landing this thing, and I was not looking out so much out the bat because I had to feed information to John, who was actually flying it, looking out the window. But the surface around our landing site and to the south turned out to be, and to the west of our landing site turned out to be fairly rough. It was very rolling terrain, and it was cratered, and also some boulders scattered across. So the maneuvering of the car across that terrain basically was very difficult to go in a real straight line. You had to, maneuver around craters. You had to avoid blocks, or big rocks, and stuff like that. But we were able to reach our main objective. So by eyeballing the terrain and following the maps that we had that were taken by Apollo 14. The problem with the maps were they were resolution. And a 15-meter crater, a 13-meter crater is a big crater, and you're going to need to drive into that thing. Right, yeah. And by the time John basically started taking over manual control, and by the time we were about 300 feet, we were in full manual control. And he had basically picked out a landing spot and came over it and just basically hovered like you do a helicopter and slowly settled into the surface trying to zero out lateral and forward and aft velocities. Turned out we were dead level, almost dead level, and Steve picked out a great spot. Turned out when I jumped out, so when we landed, the vehicle came to rest almost level. I think sort of left side down a little bit. But then after I got out, we deployed the rover, and I went around in the back to get the science package off. Gosh, it was a big crater behind us, a couple of meters. It was, right, yeah. So, but we missed it, and that gave us a, but we hadn't even seen it. That was a remarkable thing. It was something that we had not even noticed when we started at this final stage. We were scheduled to spend a couple hours power down and then to eat a meal and then to go out and start exploring, but we were 6 hours behind schedule on a landing because of a problem that we'd had in a landing in the command module. So when you put all that timeline together, 6 hour delay and suiting up and going out and all, it would turn out we'd have been awake for 35 hours, and they decided that was too long. We concurred, and so we changed our schedule so that we would take a rest period first before we went out. So what we ended up doing was to spend a couple hours power down, hour two, talking about the change of flight plan and activities and describing the surface. Taking off our suits and going to sleep. And so it was, we had a rest, 8 hour rest period, and then the next morning, after we woke up, we ate a meal, started sleeping up, and then went outside. So all of, put all that together, it was probably about 16 hours. The reflection, the lunar surface reflects the sunlight, and that reflection, and plus the earth shine, is so bright that you effectively don't see the stars. So you see, and you don't have any color in the sky because there's no atmosphere, and so the sky just looks up and you can see blackness. Anytime the sun's shining in space, basically don't see any stars. The deployment probably took hold me to this, but once John got out, he was on the porch, and he pulled the pin that released the upper chassis, part of the chassis, and then that left it at that point, and then I got out 10 minutes later, and at that point I think we started pulling on the lanyards for the pulleys and to deploy the rover, and that whole sequence probably took no longer than 15 minutes. During that sequence, it just pulls some other pins and releases the chassis, and like a landing gear on an airplane, the thing just folded, unfolded. And, so then we continued lowering it to the surface, and then once the wheels, the front wheels, the rear wheels are on the surface, we had to go up and release the pins on the front side, the front wheel, the front chassis, then we then we put it on the ground and checked to make sure the pins were all set at the hinge point, the lock pins. And then we picked it up and just walked out with it and turned it around so John could drive it off. John did, yeah. Yeah, I've got a copy of them. They're really good. That's correct.
Can you tell me about the first EVA?
Well, our first EVA, first off, we got the rover ready to go. We deployed it, then we put hung the TV camera on it. We put the geological experiments on the back, raised the suit, checked it out, all of those things, raised the seats, checked it out, all those things. The next 3 to 4 hours were involved in placing what was called the ALSEP, which stands as an acronym for Apollo Lunar Surface Experiments Package. While I carry these experiments out about 300 yards, is where we placed them, John drove the rover out there, and so that we could have the TV coverage. Then after that, we climbed into the rover, and our objective was about a place called Plum Crater, which is about, if I recall, about a mile west of our landing site. And so we aligned our navigation system, and off we went. And we found out real quick that you couldn't tell the forest from the trees. They all looked, when you looked at a map that was taken in orbit, there's a crater, and you can tell the difference, but down there on the surface, they all looked the same. And so it was difficult, but we finally found a crater that was approximately the same direction and distance that our map said we should be at Plum Crater, and so we found Plum Crater. And we spent an hour or so there, I guess. Then we drove back in the vicinity of the experiments package, and I got out, I got off the rover with the movie camera, and John did what we call the Grand Prix.
Oh, yeah, I think I see a little something
back. Yeah, and that was the only clip that we have in all of Apollo of the full rover underway. The rest of the time you just had cameras mounted on the rover and you could see yourself driving and bouncing across the moon, but you couldn't see the operation of the whole vehicle. But this Grand Prix gave the engineers an idea of what the thing looked like as it bounced across the moon. And so that was done, and after that, if I recall, we got ready to get back inside. So that was EVA-1. During the training and the actual flight, John was the driver, and my job was to navigate and to be what I call the travel guide. While we were underway, you couldn't have a TV picture because the antenna was not stabilized. Always at the earth. So we were just driving, and every 25 meters or so I'd take a picture, and I kept this running commentary going to mission control, and all the science team about what we were seeing, you know, passing this crater, and the color is this, and the rocks coverage is this, and the size of the boulders is that. You know, like a travel guide to a blind person, I guess, from there 250,000 miles away. So that was my job, to navigate us and to be the travel guide.